Since it's shortly after 1 o'clock, maybe it would be an appropriate time to begin this session. My name is Mark Gustafson, and I will be introducing the two gentlemen who will be giving papers today. The topic of this particular session is The Heart of the Law, an Approach to Ethics of the Individual in Mormonism. I find this particular subject specifically interesting because the role of ethics and aesthetics as related to ethics, to me, is an essential point of any religion which seeks to exalt the individuals within it. The principal paper will be given by Mr. Blaine Fowers, who holds a BA in psychology from Weber State College and is now in counseling at the University of Minnesota. After Mr. Fowers' paper, Mr. Kim McCall, who has a BA in philosophy from Stanford University and is now working in computer science in California, will offer his response to that. Thereafter, if the time permits, I hopefully will have a few comments of my own, then I'd like to open it up to each of you for your individual reaction. So, Mr. Fowers?
Before I begin with the paper, I'd like to make a few personal remarks about my approach to this and maybe how we can deal with some of this as we go along. First of all, one of the things that I realized after I had already submitted the paper and was that I hadn't given enough credit where credit was due. And one of those places was to Kim. In reading your paper over the last few times since I prepared it, I recognized more similarity than I had noticed at first. We had written the papers entirely independent. He wrote a paper a couple of years ago and presented it here. And what I found out was that even though if they were independent, they turned out to be very, very similar. So that's one thing I'd like to correct. It's a little bit unfortunate that this type of paper and my type of discourse ability requires that I read it in order that I can keep the compactness of the arguments and keep the sequence that they're in so that they'll be meaningful to you. The way I'd like to kind of compensate for that is if there are words or phrases that don't seem to quite make sense, feel free to raise your hand, and as far as informative questions, I'd be happy to just break for a second and answer a question about a word or a phrase, okay, so that we can talk together. And one final thing is that I was plagued the entire time I prepared the paper with the feeling of, is this really worthwhile? Is this useful to do this sort of speculation and thinking? And it almost stopped me a few times. But then, as I'll get into my paper, you'll realize that my arguments are basically formalist. And I realized that that was a consequentialist reason to stop, and so at that point I stopped thinking those things and went on with the paper in favor of the principles of learning and sharing knowledge. So with that in mind, I'll begin. This paper is an attempt to formulate what is known as a God's Law ethical system. This system will differ markedly from the traditional interpretation of duty based on God's will, as well as from a teleologically oriented God's Law theory. The process of internalization forms the basis of the system, and its end is for the moral agent to become a law in him or herself. Internalized action guides form the only real basis for duty, and thus only action undertaken based on such internalization is considered fully right action. There are two main strengths to this formulation. The first is its developmental nature. That is, it takes the believer and moral agent from obedience to knowledge, and from dependent action to independent action. The second is that it rises above the traditional difficulties with an external authority as the source of duty. Thus, this ethical system takes God's law beyond a mere set of do's and don'ts. Its purpose and process elevate the moral agent above causal chains in that his or her actions are based upon principles he or she has chosen. An internalized action guide is defined as the moral agent having taken the propositions of the divine law as his or her own, as if he or she had formulated them him or herself. I hope this sex fair language doesn't get in your way. I feel compelled to do that. This acceptance is not based upon the imposition of divine will or upon the consequences of the particular acts or principles that are chosen. I'll now proceed to outline the traditional alternatives in God's law ethics and the limitations that I feel they have. I will then detail the process of internalization itself. A model of the moral law will be presented along with a proposed method of expanding our awareness and application of that law. The divine authority view of moral obligation has as its primary premise God's status as creator and definer of moral rectitude. His position as our creator and lawmaker obligates us to do as he commands due to our dependence on him for both our existence and ultimate fate. Thus, his commands are the sole source of duty and right action. In this light, God has given us a set of commandments that delineate right and wrong action. To follow them constitutes right action, and to disobey them is to do wrongly. Thus, obeying God's will is defined as right action. In the last Sunstone Symposium, Kim McCall argued against this position on the grounds that Mormon doctrine declares that we are morally co-equal with God. This derives from the doctrine that we were not created by God and hence do not owe our existence to Him. While this position does put a substantial dent in the divine authority formulation, I do not think it deals at the fatal blow that it was intended to. The point of my attack on the divine authority position enjoys a curious combination of use by moral philosophers as well as consistency with Mormon doctrine. As I have emphasized, it is the authority of the lawmaker that translates his commands to our duties. McCall challenged that authority. I shall challenge the conception that actions can be right on the basis of external authority at all. That is, given that God does have that authority, I don't think that our actions can be based on that as a means for determining right or wrong action. Doing what God commands is not necessarily morally right action, inasmuch that rightness is independent, in this case, rightness would be independent of the characteristics of the act itself. Worse still, the rightness of the act is not contingent in any way upon the intent of the actor. This is unacceptable to the moral philosopher, since duty is both outside the act and the actor. To hold this position is to say that there is nothing in the nature of murder or adultery that makes either wrong, only that God says they are wrong. Thus, if God said it were right, consequently it would be right to commit either murder or adultery. So we need to find some other basis of defining right action. Further, this establishes a causal mode of morality, and this robs the moral agent of independently right action. And this causal mode of morality is something I'll talk quite a bit about, but we'll define later. The best we could do in such a system would be to mimic God. While this may not be bad, it is certainly not good. This last point outlines the inconsistency of a divine authority position vis-a-vis Mormonism. Inasmuch as the end of our existence is immortality and eternal life, it follows that we are to attain the same moral status as God now holds. Actions undertaken merely at his behest do not further that end, as his life is designed to do. The rightness of action must be grounded in the intent of the actor in order to allow the moral progression that is necessary for us to approach godliness. Therefore, the rightness of our actions cannot be derived simply by virtue of God's commands. The second traditional model for a God's law system of ethics is the teleological approach. The simplest version of teleological ethics is stated by the phrase, "the end justifies the means." This position defines morally right action as being those actions that bring about good results. It translates to keeping the commandments so as to be happy or to go to heaven. Note that the rightness of the act is contingent upon its results, that is, something outside the act itself. According to this version of ethics, it would be right to give to poor people in order to keep them from starving or living without shelter. At first glance, this may seem commendable. However, once again, the intent of the actor and the nature of the act are irrelevant to the goodness of the act. Intent has no bearing on rightness as long as the consequences are positive. Similarly, it is at least theoretically possible that murder or adultery might have enough benefits to enough people to seem to justify these acts in terms of the results. Go ahead.
What did you call
this? This is teleological ethics, or ethics based on consequences. When consequences dictate the rightness of an act, then although we choose which consequences we desire, our actions are controlled by the environment, more specifically, by the consequences the environment offers. Thus, when one acts because of consequentialist reasons, one is caused to act by those consequences. Hence, one's actions can always be manipulated by simply varying the consequences of any act. So in that sense, then, what can be defined as right action can always be changed simply by changing the results of that action. Thus, the common thread among these two ethical systems seem to be that the intent of the actor and the nature of the act tend to be less important than either conformity with the divine will or the results that the act generates. The argument that is implicit in rejecting these approaches to ethics is that in both cases, the moral agent acts as a part of a causal chain. One is caused to do right because of God's will or the consequences of the act. And this causal chain deals with the cause of that action being outside of the individual himself or herself, as the case is. One is caused to do what is right because of God's will or the consequences of the act. This diminishes the actor's agency and removes him or her from the status of being an end in him or herself. Does anyone have a question about what I mean by being an end in oneself? Okay, that's Kant's term, and let me explain it just a little bit. He talks about that as his idea is that we should never treat persons as means to an end, unless, or specifically, we should always treat people as ends in themselves, and not only as a means to some end for our good or their good, whichever the case may be. Okay, so it deals with our value as persons, basically, and that we're more valuable than we would be as a means to some end. And that's the primary objection I have to both of those initial theories. And that is to say that the moral agent is a means to good results or to the fulfilling of God's will in these two systems. Clearly, this is both philosophically and theologically inadequate. The third alternative is the model I am proposing. I have called it individual internalization to emphasize that it is a process of personal assimilation of the moral law. At this point, I must acknowledge my indebtedness to Immanuel Kant, the German philosopher. Many of his ideas are implicit in the propositions I am making here. While his ethical theory provides a springboard for the ideas I am proposing, there are some fundamental differences that will become apparent. Both systems, however, reflect the infinite value of rational beings in their status as ends in themselves, as well as the desired final state of becoming morally independent, a state I shall refer to as being a law in oneself. In essence, Kant's ethical theory is one of reasoning and of formulating the moral law. Thus, Kant assumes rational humans to be the measure of morality. Individual internalization is the process of discovering and absorbing the moral law, which plainly assumes that the measure of morality is greater than human reason. Kant saw the moral agent as one who derived the law through the universalization of maxims. I see the moral agent as one who discovers and adopts a law that exists independently. Kant's universalization principle was that if the rule that underlies the act that you're about to undertake, if you could conceivably make that a rule for every person in that similar situation, then it's a universalizable rule. And in that case, then it would be an acceptable rule to act upon. Whereas, as I stated, rather than formulating that ourselves, our task is to find that moral law that already exists and then to assimilate it in a similar fashion, which means that we then take that maxim as our own, as if we had formulated it. And I'll explain that a bit more as we go on. The process of internalization is defined as accepting principles or action guides, that is, rules for action, as guidelines for behavior because of their perceived rightness. The rightness of an act can only be judged by its conformity with such an internalized action guide. Thus, duty derives from within the moral agent. Thereby, moral agents are free from causal chains and can act as ends in themselves. When confronted with a moral dilemma, a law in oneself will choose an action on the basis of the principles involved, for example, justice or beneficence. To be sure, one would take environmental factors into account, but only as they bear on the principles involved and not as the primary considerations. The goal of the internalization process is that moral agents become laws in themselves. This is defined as having internalized the entire moral law through comprehending it. Thus, the moral agent becomes morally independent, which means to operate outside of causal chains. This is, of course, a gradual and stepwise progression rather than an all-or-nothing phenomenon. This process will be outlined later. God is an example of a complete law in himself and acts outside of any causal chains. That is, he does not act in order to obtain a particular consequence or because of some authority external to himself, but acts knowing that he is in accord with the moral law. Implicit in this formulation is the idea that God did not create the moral law, but discovered it and internalized it even as we are doing. This conforms well with the concept of eternal progression. For God to have inherited a celestial glory, he must have obeyed the celestial law. That he remains God implies that he continues to obey that law. Thus, God no more created the moral law than he created the earth ex nihilo. The law existed before he became God. If God does not have the law or the role of lawmaker, what do his commands signify? This line of reasoning would indicate that God has the role of lawgiver, which is to pass on the law that he himself has internalized, rather than lawmaker, one who creates and decrees laws. What of this law, then? Is the set of do's and don'ts we have received equivalent to this law? The following will make it plain that a list of instructions is neither adequate nor desirable as a model of the moral law. The simplest objection is that it is plainly impossible to outline instructions that will delineate right actions for all conceivable situations. If such a set of rules were possible, it would be so cumbersome as to be unmanageable. A second objection deals with dilemmas where there is some conflict between two rules. A simple list of rules would not inform us as to which command trumps which and under which circumstances. So we see that a mere list is inadequate. It is also unsuitable to the purpose of eternal progression, since it allows little participation on the part of the moral agent and dictates action with the taste of the divine authority approach. Yet we have been given such a list. That's plain to all of us. Its importance is reiterated constantly. We are to follow these rules to act rightly. That may be fair enough, but as I have shown, it is not enough. It appears to me, however, that these do's and don'ts are necessary. God's role as lawgiver and expounder is essential so that we can obtain an awareness of the moral law. In fact, knowledge of and obedience to these rules constitutes the first stage of internalization. And as I said, this is a developmental process, and I'll outline four stages. And the names of them are acquisition, assimilation, harmonization, and comprehension. This first stage is an initial getting acquainted phase. Moral agents at this stage typically follow these guidelines from a more or less obedience to divine authority perspective. I've shown why this is inadequate. However, it is also necessary, since one cannot assimilate something one is not well acquainted with. The next step for the moral agent is to begin to assimilate these guidelines as if she or he had formulated them him or herself. And that's the crucial point, that we're not accepting these as a result of imposed authority, but as if we had formulated them ourselves. They become then our laws. Those perceived to be right are adopted as one's own action guides. That is to say, one acts according to that rule because one perceives it to be right, not because of its consequences or because God commanded it. That is, instead of it being right to merely do what God wills, it is right to will what God wills. In essence, the moral agent commands him or herself to act according to such a rule. This is the beginning of actual internalization. A principle is adopted as if one had formulated it oneself and constitutes a duty on the strength of that internalization. Duty is defined as those acts that derived from an internalized action guide. It may be apparent at this point that I have succeeded in placing the rightness of the act with the actor through internalization, and with the act through the moral agent's perception of its rightness. It is equally plain that a moral agent at this second stage is still working basically with a list of commands, even if they are his or her own, and this entails the disadvantages of it being both cumbersome and not really giving us any way to tell which action guide would be the more important in the case of a conflict between some. And this introduces the third stage of internalization. As the moral agent internalizes action guides, she or he begins to sense the harmony among them. These action guides are not independent, but are connected in both obvious and subtle ways. This harmony becomes an instrument in internalizing new action guides. That is, if a rule is consistent with the others one has adopted, then it is a legitimate duty. If an act, even though one has no specific action guide to judge it by, is harmonious with those action guides one has internalized, then it is one's duty. One example of such harmony would be the two duties of being honest and being just with others. They are distinct in that one can be honest about being unjust, and one can be dishonest about being just. Yet they harmonize since both duties involve respecting others. Thereby, future action can be judged by the meta-duty of respect for others. Similarly, loving others, beneficence, or other meta-duties can be derived. It is in this way that conflicting guides can be resolved, by appealing to these meta-duties or through the harmonization of two duties that seem to conflict with one another. Once again, however, it appears that the set of internalized action guides and meta-duties may be getting cumbersome. An organizing principle is needed. Such a central function is accomplished in the fourth stage of internalization. As more and more interconnection between action guides are made, the moral agent begins to sense the essence of those duties. This essence is the source of the duties. That is, specific duties are the translation of this essence of the law in given situations. This essence is the heart of the law. When the moral agent fully comprehends and assimilates this essence, then she or he becomes a complete law in him or herself. This is what qualifies and empowers God to be the lawgiver. As a complete law in himself, he comprehends this essence and has therefore given the sets of laws that are useful in first-level internalization. These guidelines are a means to the end of the moral agent's progress towards becoming a law in him or herself. It is the accomplishment of that degree of internalization that allows one to become morally independent. In order to further clarify the structure of this progression and the moral law, a geometric analogy might be useful here. And this is merely to point out a way of looking at that so we can sort of conceptualize what I'm saying. A sphere is an appropriate model. The surface of a sphere is made up of an infinite number of points. Each point can represent an action guide. The number of action guides is also infinite due to the countless array of different situations the moral agent might encounter. The sphere is not empty, but contains that essence of the law I have referred to. The relatedness of action guides are the means of seeing this essence. Respect for others is one such connection. And just as the individual action guides are points on the sphere, this harmony, this connection between points on the sphere can be thought of a line that passes through the inside of the sphere. It allows us to recognize the interrelationship of justice and honesty, that is, respect for others. Respect isn't the essence itself, but it illuminates it. These connections illuminate this essence in a similar way to how a flashlight shows the presence of fog on a dark night. One sees the light as it strikes the fog, but the light is not the fog, and without the light, the fog is invisible. These analogies are illustrations designed to explain in words a perception and comprehension that is difficult, if not impossible, to express verbally. It is, in the fullest sense of the expression, the spirit of the law. To summarize the process of internalization, there are four stages. The first is obedience to rules set down by God. These rules form duty by virtue of His authority in this stage. The second step is the individual's acceptance of these duties because she or he perceives them to be right. And this is, again, as if they had formulated them themselves. The basis of duty is this personal acceptance or internalization. The third stage consists of recognizing the interrelationships among action guides and discovering one's duty by virtue of its harmony with those internalized rules. The final phase is the comprehension of the essence of the moral law from which the specific duties come. Duty is established according to the harmony of the act with this internalized sense of the law. These stages do, of course, overlap. However, I think that their order is relatively fixed. This same scheme of development serves as a measure of the rightness of an act. The higher the level of internalization that one is acting under, the more right the action is. That is, to give to the poor because God commands is good, but not as desirable as giving to the poor because one recognizes that it is a good thing to do. One last note on the nature of this model of morality deals with its subjective process. Perhaps you've noticed that up to this point. Subjective perception and action are essential and inescapable to this model. The entire internalization process depends on the moral agent's perception of the law. This follows given that the theme of the law is raising individuals to laws in themselves. This paper has shown, I hope, the inadequacy of the divine authority and teleological formulations of God's law ethics based on their causal nature. It has proposed a system of ethics that has as its center the status of rational beings as ends in themselves. The mechanics of the system is the internalization process. This is defined as the assimilation and comprehension of the moral law, the purpose of which is to elevate the moral agent to the level of being a law in him or herself. God assists us in this process through instruction, example, and the provision of an environment in which we can learn these basic lessons. To become a law in oneself is to have fully internalized the law through the outlined stages of acquisition, assimilation, harmonization, and comprehension of the law.
I'd like to thank Blaine Fowers for a stimulating and challenging paper which contains a creative and courageous run at a fence which I can testify is a very difficult and daunting one. Let me try to describe briefly the problem that I see this paper as addressing. It is to give a general account of morality, an explanation of duty, what he calls an ethical system, which harmonizes and integrates the obligatoriness of God's commandments with the conviction common at least since Kant, and I think fairly explicit in the Sermon on the Mount, that is not conformity with external rules, but rather the nature of the spirit or will of the actor that determines the rightness of an act. You can see that there might be a problem there. Fowers begins this integration by flatly rejecting the idea that God's commanding an action can make that action obligatory. He claims to have a better way to do that than I did in my paper, and I just want you to know I agree. There were reasons for my argument in my paper, if anybody is familiar with it, but it wasn't that it was the best argument, at least not anymore. But he preserves a place for God's commandments. Okay, he rejects the idea that God's commanding actually, in and of itself, makes something obligatory on us. He preserves a place, however, for God's commandments as guides toward our discovery of more and more general principles of the moral law, which eventually, through experience and something like inductive generalization, lead us to comprehend and embrace the apparently indescribable essence of that law. You know what inductive generalization is? You see a bunch of specific instances of something, and gradually you figure out what they're specific instances of, and you find more and more general truths that way. That's supposedly how science works. Okay. At each stage in our progression, we are obligated only to obey those principles we have accepted and, in some sense, legislated for ourselves. Okay. This centers the rightness of action in the intent, or at least in the mind, of the actor. This, Fowers holds, frees the will from external determination, a causal chain, allowing it to be independently good. I want to state that since I, at least on Saturdays, am an enthusiastic Kantian myself, I see this as a crucial and most exciting facet of the paper, a necessary part of any attempt to explain moral obligation. So you should all be jumping up and down that he said that. Most of the rest of what I will say will be the bad news. That was the good news. Now I'm going to go into being critical of the paper. Having been in both positions here and there before, I want you to know that it's infinitely easier to be in my spot, to sit and snipe or take pot shots at a few weaknesses in someone else's paper. Right, Mark? I responded to Mark last year. Than to be in Fowler's spot and confront one of the two or three hardest questions ever asked and try to develop a creative and unassailable answer. Can't be done. So here come a few, from my point of view, criticisms. I think my role now is to point out the inconsistencies or arguments that may not work. First, I want to deal with a couple of claims about that he made that he thought made his argument a good one. Okay, first of them is that his system differs markedly from a teleological theory. Okay, that's the way I pronounce that word. Teleology, remember, is bases the rightness of an action on the goodness of the result. Okay, very elegant system. Whatever tends to give good results is the right thing to do, and reduces the question of rightness to the question of goodness. There are, however, strong indications in the paper that Fowler's system is, in fact, teleological. When he wishes to defend his view, he uses teleological language, and I'll just cite four places. He talks about this ethical system taking God's law beyond a mere set of do's and don'ts. Its purpose and process is to elevate the moral agent above causal chains in that blah, 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 blah. Okay, so he says that there's a purpose to his ethical system. Okay, so if he's justifying the ethical system based on some purpose that it has, that's teleological language. He says the rightness of an action must be grounded in the intent of the actor in order to allow the moral progression that is necessary for us to approach godliness. Okay, he's talking about an end toward which morality ought to be aiming, namely progression toward godliness. Okay. I had a couple other things I want to show you. He says the theme of the law, the moral law, he capitalizes, is raising individuals to laws in themselves. Okay, this idea of progression, very common in Mormonism, just universal when we go into sacrament meeting to talk about why things are right and wrong. We talk about what they do for us, acting right and wrong. And that's teleological defense of our morality. Okay, he talks about the internalization process is the assimilation and comprehension of the moral law, the purpose of which is to elevate the moral agent to the level of being a law in him or herself. Okay, so that's when he gets down to defending some of his views, he uses teleological language, and so do I, and so do most of you. Okay. One of Fowler's main arguments for the preferability of his theory, the other main one, is that it elevates or frees people from causal chains. Let's see if I can get that exactly right. Acting out of principles which we ourselves have accepted because we perceive them to be right, that's very important, frees us from acting as part of a causal chain, preserving, and this is the argument for this thing, preserving our dignity and allowing us to be ends and laws in ourselves rather than means to ends. Can't be overstated how important that was to Kant, the idea that the will is autonomous and not taking orders from other things in the universe, either the pleasures of our body or the commands of God. Okay, the problem is, he divorces himself from Kant in a very important way that he pointed out very clearly. If you recall, Kant has us legislating the entire moral law through our process of universalizing the principles behind our actions, seeing if they would make good laws, whereas Faust has us discovering moral laws which are independent of ourselves, external to ourselves. Okay, so if the rightness of those principles, which we endorse, which we accept, is independent of us and of our reasoning, something we discover, how is that any less a cause of the rightness of our actions than is a commandment of God? What is the difference as far as moral independence of the individual is concerned between acting out of conformity to the will of an external authority, like God, and acting out of conformity to an external principle or set of principles like the moral law? Okay, as long as what we're getting is outside of ourselves that's determining for us what we ought to do, then we're not completely a law in ourselves. Let me just defend that terminology just for a second, law in ourselves. It sounds like a whole lot like something that we're told very much not to be in DNC 88, which is a law unto ourselves. But we also have the idea that the truly moral person is one who has the law written in his heart and is determining for himself, through his will being in conformity with God's, what he ought to be doing. I'll come back to that, I think. Okay. Enough for those kinds of gripes. I want to examine the internalization theory of duty and see whether it fulfills its assigned role as being an ethical system. Okay. What is the task of an ethical system? It is always identified as to answer the question, how ought people to behave? The attempt to defend an answer to this question, any answer that happens to be given, usually leads to the much more basic and, I think, profound question, what is it that makes right acts right? Okay. If I understand Fowler's paper, his answer is that right action is action done out of conformity with principles the actor has accepted because of their perceived rightness. Okay. That's at least true in the first three of the four stages. And I think the same thing still goes on in the fourth stage. There are, then, two more or less independent aspects of the moral life. One is the self-legislation process, deciding what you're going to decide are your duty, which principles you're going to accept because of their perceived rightness. And the other is the behavior out of obedience to our self-imposed action guides. The second of these is quite straightforward to understand, even if it's not so easy to do. You know, you just do what you said you're going to do, what you told yourself is right. I wish to focus on the first, that is, accepting principles because of their perceived rightness. How do we perceive the rightness of a principle? What standards do we measure it by? What makes that principle right? My understanding of what Fowler's answer to this question would be, and I'm reading between the lines, is that what makes it right is its consonance with what he calls the heart or essence of the law. Okay, this is an essentially, let's see if I can make more sense out of that. What is it that makes a particular thing like honesty or justice, which were his two examples, or beneficence, right principles behind actions, or what is it that makes not stealing and not lying as specific instances of action guides correct and worthy of our acceptance as our internalized action guides. I think that it is their harmony with the essence of the law. Okay, God wrote the specific ones and wanted us to reason to the intermediate ones because they were so consonant with the essence of the law. And I'll get to the question of the essence of the law later. But so the justification of any of these particular things which we're supposed to accept is essentially deductive. Okay, there's this one general source thing, which is this heart of the law, our basic duty or something like that, of which all the specific duties we have are just specific instances tailored to the situation that we find ourselves in. So that justification is essentially deductive. Okay, but we perceive the rightness of those things inductively. Okay, through its unification of or explanation of more specific moral beliefs we already hold. Something like that. This creates real problems. The fact that this fact that what makes a principle right and how we discover that it is right are different. Okay, there is on this view, so far as I can see, no way to check whether the initial specific beliefs from which we generalize to find the more essential beliefs are in fact correct, that is, likely to lead to correct principles, or to check that the principles which we generalize to are correct. Okay, as this building up these meta duties. And there's no way to check that they're correct except their harmony with something that we haven't yet discovered. Okay, we might just as easily begin to internalize the commands of etiquette or the rules of our local subculture, in our case, our Mormon subculture, which didn't happen to be exactly God's commandments. There's a whole set of competing commandments for us to try to obey, okay? And some of them are unified by very clear principles. The law of the jungle is one that we might start internalizing, getting general principles of, and there's almost certainly a central, essential principle, which is survival above all else, behind the law of the jungle. So there's real danger, unless we have some idea, or unless this ethical system will provide us some standard by which to judge what actions are right or what little principles that we're reasoning to are right, that we're going to go off in the wrong direction and find some other essence besides the essence of morality. And in fact, I think that this does happen in our culture. The question, one sort of interesting question at this point is whether or not a person who reasons to these things and sort of legislates for himself based on etiquette, a general principle that says, do unto others so as to cause the least friction, or something like that, whatever's behind etiquette, is morally obligated to obey that command since he's legislated it for himself. Anyway, we have a major problem then that we're using an inductive process to get at some core truth, but the validity of the evidence, the specific instances we use to get there, can be judged only by that evidence's relationship to the core that we're trying to get at. Okay, we may perceive a principle, but we cannot perceive its rightness, since that consists in its relationship to higher principles we haven't yet discovered. Okay, one more question remains about this self-legislation process. Fars has described it as something we do, sort of gradually moving up a ladder from specific to general duties and understandings, much like we learn anything. Language learning is very much that way. As a kid is presented with a random assortment of sentences, gradually you begin to develop the general principles of grammar inside yourself, even though you're not aware of them. But for this to be an account of duty, we need to establish our obligation to move up the ladder. Okay, it's fine to say people do that, some people do and some people don't, but if it's our duty to progress in this way, we need to establish some kind of obligation to move up the ladder. It's not enough to just say people do it or don't do it. This can probably be done. As a matter of fact, I think the argument, the paper sort of does it, but it'll be hard to do without teleological arguments, which are the main ones we tend to use in that sort of a situation. Okay, the last question I wish to discuss from the paper directly concerns the final step in this internalization progression, the sensing and eventual comprehension of the essence of the moral law. Fowers reasons that we're getting a whole bunch of these meta-duties, and they're sort of proliferating just like the specific rules were. And so one thing that he needs is an organizational principle for the meta-duties, something to unify them and to make them coherent. And he also reasons that this will be the sort of the most generic duty, translating to specific situational duties dependent on specific situations. Sorry about that. What it seems to me that he's done in this situation is identified a very important role, okay, and he's given it a name, essence, but he hasn't given it any content. Okay, I have several examples in my bag of tricks of things like that. Okay, the first one, let's see, what was it going to be? The first one is that you all know that light is waves, and waves can only travel in some kind of medium, and so since the light can get to star from stars to here, we have this thing here that I call ether, which is the medium in which the things exist, in which light travels. Okay, I've got a name for something, but there's no thing like it. Okay, another one, some people contend, and some people would allege that people go through contradictory sorts of behavior at different times, and sometimes they appear to act one way and sometimes another way. So there must be two competing principles inside each of these people, and we'll call one of them the id and the other the superego. Okay? And so we have names for things, but there's no guarantee that those things really exist. My favorite ones come from the last couple days of listening to talks. Orson Pratt, this is essentially what people believe that what logical positivists think we're doing when we use the term God. Okay, the ultimate object of religious worship, that than which nothing greater can be conceived. You pick that out of your bag. You've got names for it. You've got a role for it to play. But there's no guarantee that there's anything like that. Okay, and if we're trying to give light, shed light on something, and I'll talk about light in just a second. We need to say more about what it is. Okay, Orson Pratt can talk about every atom in the universe containing the fullness of God's justice and understanding and love, and it's just words. Okay, until he gets more specific and fills in the blanks that thing causes. Okay, so we ought to try to be able to say something about what this thing is. And I would challenge each of you who believes that there's any kind of duty in this life and any kind of organization to what God wants us to do or what we ought to be doing, to try to think for yourself, what is the heart of the law for you? What is the essence of the law? I think that there is such a thing, okay? But unless we start filling in that blank, we don't know what we're talking about. And in fact, I tried for myself one night, thinking about this paper, to fill that in for myself. And it's a very interesting exercise to try to determine where your personal moral progression is, either to discover what plays that role for you or what you think ought to play it. And I could think of two sorts of things that I mean, this is the question I ask my 9-year-olds in primary every week until they get it right. You know, what is the greatest commandment? Is there one thing that God wants that unifies all of our specific duties? And it might really be that love of our fellow man or love of God can play that role for us. To Kant, it was something very much like the Golden Rule. The sort of respect that we have to have for everybody else on the same level as ourselves. Okay. And so I think a paper that tries to get at this thing should try to fill in these sorts of blanks rather than use poetic imagery, mystical imagery about fog and things like that. I have a very good friend who read this paper in order to tell me what to say about it, and she said that she really didn't like the fog analogy. I'm poetic enough at the right time of evenings to enjoy that kind of imagery, but her feelings about fog were that it obscures things, that light doesn't go through it, that it doesn't illuminate, that it causes accidents, and people make big mistakes because they don't see things in the fog. And I think that that's a good comment on mysticism in general, or at least a useful one for our thinking, that it does behoove us to try to be very clear. Am I going over? Yes, I'm sorry. Okay. The problem... Okay, so we haven't said exactly what we mean by the essence of the law. And it may be that Blaine doesn't want to say he understands it yet, and maybe that none of us understands it yet. And the problem with that is that if that's true, then whatever degree of morality we manage to develop in this life, it must be in a very important sense a matter of luck, of internalizing the right rules, since without that essence, we don't really have any way to judge. And without some comprehension of that essence, we don't have much of a way to judge what's right and what's wrong in the specific things that we do generalize to. Let me just for 1 minute put on my hat. I have a friend who's actually in this room who once came to a party wearing a hat that said, you know, instead of 10-4, good buddy, it said Kafka. And I thought that was the most horrible thing I'd ever seen. And so I had to get one of a similar sort. Kant does have an answer to this question. To Kant, the standard by which we judge each of the principles that we want to live by is, I'll take this off because you're all smiling, is immediately available to everybody. Okay, he believes that reason is similar enough in all of us that when we push ourselves to understand what our duty is, we understand, and I can't give you the whole argument, that obedience to law means living by principles that you wish would be laws for everybody. Okay, living by principles, acting out of subjective motivations which you wish everybody would act out of. Okay, it's a sort of a subjective, motivational version of the golden rule. Okay, and that sort of standard by which to judge is available to everybody. This overcomes the inductive-deductive problem by giving us each the heart of the law immediately, a real advantage to Kant's system. It sounds a little bit dry, I guess. It's a very intellectual thing. Kant is the driest of writers. But the idea that we are constantly comparing our actions to what we want everybody else to do does have a fair ring of truth to me. And the fact that that way we legislate for ourselves the laws that we want the whole world to obey creates true autonomy, true freedom from causation by external things. We are legislating our own laws. And become a law in ourselves, and hopefully not unto ourselves, because we can't make exceptions in our own case, because it has to be what we want everybody else to do in relation to us as well. Thank you very much.
I believe Blaine has a very brief response to Kim's paper, and then I have some comments on both of theirs, and hopefully if we have enough time left, we'll open it up. Blaine?
Primarily what I wanted to do was express my appreciation for the opportunity to present the paper and also to get Kim's response. I'm sure we could talk well into tomorrow on the way we see these things. But what it does for me is that I've hammered on this thing for a number of years and it's starting to get stale with just my ideas. And so getting some other ideas from him and perhaps from you will help me to bridge some of the gaps that are in the paper and that I'm glad to have pointed out. Thanks.
This is an especially delightful situation because I finally get to criticize Kim and some of his comments. Let me just briefly go over my point because I know we're running over. It seems to me that the metaphysical... Strange comment. It seems to me that the metaphysical essence of Mormonism is that reality exists independent of any person, God or mortal human being. If that is true, then it seems as a corollary that God became God through a process of obedience to laws independent of that entity. Now, if all that is true, it seems to me that God is irrelevant to moral concerns. Let me explain that just very briefly. It seems to me that morality becomes a complex interaction of intent, of the intent of the actor and the nature of the act being committed. Namely, a person can innocently do a good act or stupidly do a good act or bad act, as the case may be. The essence of morality, it seems to me, cannot be discerned by examining the will of any entity, whether it is a lawgiver or a lawmaker. We are talking about approaching in some objective way, if you will, the nature of reality around us. And the only way you can do that is to, in my own view, look at a complex interaction which takes into account intent and result with respect to the long-term interests of that individual, which in the Mormon context is a very long-term viewpoint, several hundreds of thousands of years, and infinity. It seems to me that both of the both the paper and to a lesser extent Kim's response to it ignore to me what to me is the central point, and that is that if you argue for the Mormon metaphysic, God, if he plays a role in morality at all, is only contingently that of a rule maker. It is not a sufficient model. It is certainly not a necessary model. The process that they went through to become gods is the process we must go through. At best, they are a signpost. The only way to back out of that problem, it seems to me, is to maintain that the gods are essentially different creatures than humanity, which we reject as the first premise. Therefore, I must conclude that the gods, all of them, are essentially irrelevant to moral concerns. You're on your own, and you've got to cut it on your own. Let me again thank both Mr. Fowers and Mr. McCall for an excellent paper, an excellent response, and I've appreciated being here too. Thank you for coming.